Hi, it's Brendan O'Neill here. I wanted to let you know about an event that is taking place in New York City on the 29th of January. It's called Should We Be Free to Hate? I will be moderating it. We will be looking at the whole question of hate speech and whether hate speech is free speech with Nadine Strossen, the law professor and former president of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Paul Coleman of the Alliance Defending Freedom. Those two will be joining me to have a free, frank, open discussion about hate speech and free speech. That's at the New York Law School in the evening on the 29th of January. It's a free event, so for more information and to register, go to spiked-online.com, and I hope to see you there. Now, on with the show.
One of the things I always ask people who've also been publicly shamed, and, you know, when we see each other, we gravitate naturally towards one another. It's like a kind of secret club of the deplorables. One of the first questions I always ask is, you know, did you lose any weight? And the answer is always yes, about 2 stone. And when you are at the centre of one of
the storm diet,
it must be some kind of primitive survival instinct kicking in. You know you're going to have to run away from this mob.
Hello and welcome to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill. This is a monthly podcast in which an esteemed guest joins me to talk about the big ideas, the bad ideas, the problems and the controversies of life in the early 21st century. This month I am delighted to be joined by Toby Young. Toby is a columnist, an author and an educationalist. He founded the West London Free School and he was director of the New Schools Network, which is a charity that helps with the founding of free schools in the state school sector in England. He has written for numerous publications and he is currently a columnist for The Spectator. He is also the London Associate Editor for Quillette magazine. He is author of the memoir How to Lose Friends and Alienate People about his time as a contributing editor at Vanity Fair in New York. In the film version, Toby was played by Simon Pegg. And the film led the Irish Times to publish an article with the headline, Just How Horrible is Toby Young? And I'm pleased and relieved to say that the Irish Times came to the conclusion that Toby Young is not very horrible at all. Toby, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brendan.
It isn't often I kick off a podcast conversation by asking my guest about the falling apart of aspects of his or her life, but I feel with you it's kind of necessary. You wrote a piece shortly before Christmas about the impact that being shamed and hounded online has had on your life, even leading to a decline in Christmas cards and party invitations and various other things. And even I, despite being someone who has always found social media to be a quite ugly, abrasive environment, even I was shocked by the response to your piece. So let's start with the issue of public shaming. Around about this time last year, you were in the eye of a Twitter storm over your appointment to the Office for Students. Some people discovered old tweets of yours, jokey, silly, sexist tweets, one about breasts and a few things like that. And within days, you were out on your ear. So can you, to begin with, recount what happened and what that was like?
Yes. I was appointed to this new regulator. It's a regulator of English universities called the Office for Students, as you said. And it was announced on at a minute after midnight on January the 1st. And The Guardian broke the story. And their headline was something like, Toby Young to lead or help lead new universities regulator. And all these sleuths on Twitter concluded that the government were trying to slip this news out at a particular busy time because they didn't want anyone to focus on it. So they weren't going to let them get away with that. And so I immediately started trending on Twitter. And it was all these people saying how I wasn't a fit and proper person to serve on the board of this new regulator. And they made it sound as though this was a kind of huge, you know, cherry that I'd been handed by my cronies in the government, not quite realizing that actually it was a voluntary position, which involved, you know, serving as a non-executive director on a board, which was going to meet, I think, 4 times a year. It was something one does out of a sense of public duty, not because, you know, you're getting paid lots of money to do it, or it's going to give you kind of all sorts of powers that you've been seeking. I mean, it was sort of ludicrous that people thought, how dare the government give this fantastic, brilliant job to this kind of reprobate? Yeah. Shouldn't they give it to someone much more worthy? Well, you know, not that many people want to do these jobs. You know, it's not a huge amount of fun sitting in a committee room in Whitehall for kind of 3 or 4 hours while you discuss kind of one paragraph in a kind of, you know, set of guidance. I mean, it's you know, it's pretty boring, really. And I wasn't going to help lead this regulator. It was wildly exaggerated. But anyway, so there was this sort of pile-on. And people immediately set to work kind of ploughing through everything I'd ever written, dating back to 1987. Jeez. So I wrote an essay in a collection of essays called The Oxford Myth in 87, and I took on the inflammatory subject of class at Oxford. Someone had quote-mined this piece and made it sound as though I was this horrific snob. And Paul Nascent, this kind of journalist-turned-arch-Corbynista, tweeted that the reason I'd been given this job on this new regulator was because the Tories wanted to stop working-class children going to university. And that's why they'd appointed me, because that was their agenda. I mean, it was all kind of ludicrous. And you sort of thought when people were saying these things, well, do they really believe them, or are they just pretending to believe them in order to score political points? And it's always hard to tell, and perhaps they don't know themselves. But, you know, the offence archaeologists, as Freddie de Boer, this American essayist, has called them, you know, were busy at work. At one point, Fraser Nelson, my editor at The Spectator, wrote a piece defending me, and he pointed out that in The Spectator's archives, the top 10 most searched for articles were all articles by me, dating back to 1822. I mean, it was extraordinary, and it was all kind of, you know, my detractors searching, scouring, you know, the internet for reasons to discredit me. But I'll give one more example. I won't bang on for too long, but someone dug up a piece I'd written in The Spectator in 2001, and it was praising the British Board of Film Classification for being a bit more liberal in its attitude towards pornography. And I sort of, you know, made the kind of standard libertarian argument that in countries with more draconian pornography laws like Saudi Arabia, there isn't necessarily less sexual assault. And the links between liberal pornography laws and sex crimes is extremely tenuous, very hard to stand up. The evidence is threadbare and so forth. A fairly reasonable kind of libertarian case for liberalising censorship laws around pornography. And the chief sub at The Spectator, bit of a wag, had written the headline "Confessions of a Porn Addict," which I felt was, you know, didn't quite do the seriousness of my argument justice at the time, but nonetheless, you know, took it on the chin. It was quite funny. So someone dug up this article in the archives, screen grabbed that headline, stuck it on Twitter, and literally within 20 minutes, headline in the Evening Standard: "Pressure mounts on Theresa May as university czar confesses to being porn addict." And it was like, yeah, confesses, not really. And it was, you know, in 2001. Yeah. And then the Times followed up the same day with an almost identical headline. And they, as you said, dug up all these various inappropriate things I'd tweeted kind of late at night, stupid things I'd said, which I wish I hadn't tweeted. But nonetheless, you know, they were out there and people dredged them up. In the end, you know, there was a petition calling for my head, which I think was signed by almost 250,000 people. There was a kind of press pack on my doorstep, kind of, you know, monstering my wife every time she tried to leave the house. My daughter, 14, stopped going to school. I was also running, as you said in your intro, another charity at that time, which was, you know, very dependent on the goodwill of the government for various things, including, you know, most of its budget. So I felt that the prudent thing would be to step down, which I duly did. I perhaps naively thought that stepping down and apologising would draw a line under the whole affair. But actually, that turned out to be a mistake. And I then lost a number of other positions. So I had to step down as a Fulbright commissioner. I'd served on the Fulbright commission since 2014. I was defenestrated as an honorary fellow of Buckingham University, which was disappointing because Buckingham, as you know, was set up by Margaret Thatcher. You would have thought, if any, but no. I eventually had to step down from my job running the Free Schools charity. And I also, in the end, stepped down from the board of the charity I'd set up, which these four free schools I'd helped co-found sat within. So I lost five positions.
But I think one of the dark ironies of that whole affair, which I thought was a pretty repulsive example of the trend for public shaming, was precisely that you had done a far greater amount of work for education, particularly for underprivileged people, students, than any of your critics. But I want to come on to education in a second. Yep. The other thing I was going to ask you in relation to that thing, that episode, I think offence archaeology is a very good description of this, where people go digging and digging and digging to find some dirt that they can throw at you in order to shame you and hound you and embarrass you and ideally get you sacked. But one thing I'm interested in, people will often say, sometimes these Twitch hunters will have a moment of regret a few months down the line and say, oh, we didn't mean for all that to happen. Gavin McInnes, who I'm not particularly a fan of, but he said it's akin to a bull in a china shop saying, oh, what happened to all these plates? You know, they kind of start this Twitter storm and then things spin out of control and then they kind of backtrack slightly. But what I find interesting about the analysis of Twitter storms like the one you suffered is that people will often say, well, this proves that there is a problem with technology because everyone puts it out there. Everything that you write is online now. You don't have to actually go to the British Library to find it. You can tweet at midnight and it's there and people can see it. But I often wonder if the technological explanation is actually a cover for the far greater cultural dynamic behind these Twitch ons and the motive behind them, which seems to me that technology might facilitate it, but there is a cultural dynamic, there's a cultural motive, which seems to me to be one of extreme censoriousness and vindictiveness and bitterness, all of which I thought were really well illustrated in the attacks on you.
Yeah, I think I think you make an interesting point. It's an interesting question as to whether people who participate in these mobbings ever experience pangs of guilt. Mm. I've yet to encounter anyone who has said to me, "Gosh, I don't know what came over me. I was overcome with bloodlust, but actually, you're a decent guy, and I'm sorry." No, that hasn't happened. I think one of the reasons people don't, feel pangs of conscience about participating in these pylons is because so many people participate in them. So there's a dilution of personal responsibility. It's a bit like, the conspiracy to murder Julius Caesar. If there are, if it's not just one person sticking the knife in, but multiple people, then that makes it easier to do. So I think a philosopher actually read an interesting piece about how responsibility can be diluted in this way, and that provides people with a license to be much crueler and more sadistic than they would be if it was just them acting alone, and they were just causing the damage inflicted themselves as a single individual. Mm-hmm. But I also think that, the human mind is, ingenious at furnishing itself with pretexts to be sadistic and cruel and participate in these kinds of ritual mobbings. Someone who was publicly shamed for completely spurious reasons wrote a really good piece in a Christian magazine called First Things, a woman called Helen. And she was shamed by her boyfriend, whom she'd just broken up with, on a C-SPAN broadcast. So he launched into this rant against what a terrible human being she was because she'd broken up with him. And it, it went viral. And for years, this dogged her. She moved to Australia and joined a think tank, wrote a very serious report. And when it was discussed in the Australian Parliament, an MP brought up the fact that she dumped her boyfriend. It was just ridiculous. But anyway, she said that when people have furnished themselves with what they think of as a decent pretext for piling on, then, the floodgates open. And there is, after that, no restraint, no pang of conscience about what they'll allow themselves to say.
Absolutely. And it can target the most thoroughly decent people. The person you're talking about is Helen Andrews,
yep.
who I worked with in Australia for a brief period of time at the think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies. And that has followed her around. This footage of her boyfriend, her then boyfriend, slagging her off on TV in sometimes a fairly misogynistic way. You know, who is this woman who is so awful that she had to be dumped on TV? I think one of the things I often wonder about in relation to this is the motive behind these attacks. Now, I've heard many different explanations. Some people say it's part of human nature, going back, you know, millennia to...
Well, before we get to that, can we just want to make one further point? One of the differences, I think, between being publicly shamed today in the present environment and being publicly shamed 50 years ago is that, take someone like Profumo. So Profumo, involved in a sex scandal, resigned, was publicly shamed, and rehabilitated himself by going off to work at Toynbee Hall, not far from here, for decades until he was more or less completely rehabilitated. I think he was given an honour. You know, he was part of the kind of social circle of the Queen and so forth. One of the reasons he was able... one of the reasons he had that avenue available to him is partly because we were a more forgiving Christian culture back then, but partly, I think, because the papers could collectively decide that someone had been punished enough and they weren't going to dredge up their sins over and over again or every time they raised their head. But now, with social media, every time, no matter how far in the past the particular scandal or the misdemeanors they've accused of were committed, every time they raise their head, the pile-on repeats itself. Yeah. And I think it makes it very difficult for anyone who's been subject of a public shaming now to rehabilitate themselves. Yeah. They're just not allowed to. There isn't a mechanism by which they can atone for their sins, expiate their guilt.
I completely agree. And I think one of the things that worries me most about the... culture we live in at the moment is the calling into question of rehabilitation itself, the possibility of it, the wisdom of it. People now, particularly in relation to Me Too, which is very different from your example because you didn't actually harass or alarm or abuse anyone, but even in relation to something like Me Too, you can see this suspicion and cynicism about the entire idea of rehabilitation. If you look at someone like Louis C.K., who was cast out into the wilderness for a year or so when he confessed to having done some slightly dodgy, but
much dodgier than anything I ever did,
dodgier than anything you ever did. I think that's really important to establish. but I think across the board, whether it's someone who just said things that people disagree with, which is your case, or did things which we can all agree are regrettable, but surely you can be rehabilitated afterwards. Across the board, there is this instinct to leave people out in the cold forever and ever. But something you just said reminded me of the question that I wanted just to put again, which is, so you say that, you know, the social media phenomenon means that rehabilitation is always put off because you can always be constantly, instantly reminded of the thing Toby Young said in 2008 or whatever it might be. But behind the technological capacity to put off the possibility of rehabilitation, there is also, I think, a broader, deeper cultural discomfort with any idea of forgiveness, with any idea of openness or freedom or generosity. And I wonder, so something I think about a lot is what is the motive behind these mass mobbings, these mass houndings. And I think a part of it is this sense of an urge for moral distinction. People need to morally distinguish themselves. Virtue signaling, I think, is sometimes too weak a phrase to describe what's going on. But there is this desire to demonstrate your own virtue and decency and goodness. And in a time in which the old political, religious, traditional frameworks are kind of falling apart, you need to find other means through which to do that. And so I think significant numbers of people do it by saying, "I hate Toby Young."
Yeah.
So there's this, they need demons,
yep.
and they will find them anywhere, and they will keep them as demons for as long as possible because it benefits them.
Yeah. So Jonathan Haidt has written about this. He wrote about it in The Righteous Mind. He's written and talked about it elsewhere. It's essentially a tribal impulse, which is an ineradicable part of human nature. And part of creating a tribe sense of identity and molding it into a kind of cohesive social unit involves dividing people, sorting people into members of the in-group and members of the out-group. And members of the out-group are always cast as demons, as people who have transgressed the sacred principles upheld by members of the in-group. And in primitive societies, characterized by pagan forms of religious worship, you know, being designated as a member of the out-group can be fatal.
Yeah.
You know, even in some Christian societies. So the history of Christianity is littered with people who've been designated as members of the out-group being treated appallingly, in some cases tortured and killed. But I think one of the benefits of organized religion, and not just Christianity, but take Christianity, is that it did devise this mechanism for reconciliation between members of the in-group and the out-group. Mm. And it provided a portal through which someone who had been pushed out by the in-group for transgressing against the innocent could be allowed back in, yeah, could be rehabilitated. So forgiveness played that part, yeah, and that plays a central part in Christianity, as it does in some other organized religions. What I think is different about something like the social justice movement. I mean, I think it would be inaccurate to say it's just social justice warriors who, yeah, engage in this kind of tribal sorting and public shaming, but certainly 80-85% of the public shamings are people being shamed by the left, often, you know, people on the left being shamed by other members of the, but nonetheless. So one of the characteristics of the social justice movement is that it's inherited this vernacular of innocence and transgression. It engages in this tribal sorting, and it's inherited many aspects, not just that aspect, but many aspects of the kind of Puritan Protestant tradition, but without any sort of device for the rehabilitation, yeah, of people who've been branded, othered in this way. So there isn't once you've been painted, yeah, you know, once you've been targeted, you know, that's it. You know, you're never going to be allowed back into their charm circle. They're never, yeah, going to regard you as a fully human person, deserving of the rights and respect and the due process that a member of the in-group is.
I think that's a really important point. And I find that so much of modern supposedly progressive politics feels quite religious, but without the good qualities of religion. So without redemption, yeah, without the forgiveness, without the idea that if you deny yourself certain luxuries in this life, you'll have a good life next time. Not all that stuff, which had, yes, something going for it, has been completely pushed aside. And instead, it's just the punishment. It's just the casting out with, yes, no option of ever coming back. But I think, so are you saying that some of these, I mean, later on in this discussion, we will come on to the question of how much of human behavior can be defined in kind of evolutionary terms, mm-hmm, but are you suggesting that some of these people who think they're super progressive because they rage against Toby Young when he's on the Today program, or because they constantly berate people who are Roger Scruton, for example, mm-hmm, who they think is an inappropriate person to advise the government on housing, they consider themselves progressive, but you think that they are actually demonstrating some fairly primitive instincts,
yes,
in how they behave?
I think that's I think it's not just that they're allowing these primitive atavistic tribal feelings to dictate their actions. And there is something about social media which kind of provides a gateway,
yeah,
for those atavistic impulses to express themselves. I think maybe because people are using their hands and there's something quite aggressive about punching or pressing keys. Anyway, we could talk about that. But it's also, you know, there's also something deeply authoritarian about it. Mm. I mean, you know, during the height of when I was being mobbed, you have this kind of fear that this kind of frenzy, this blood-crazed, bloodlust frenzy that's taking place on Twitter and elsewhere will spill over into real life. Mm-hmm. And this you kind of have the feelings that you imagine the central character in Apocalypto, that wonderful kind of fried brain Mel Gibson picture, when he's being pursued by a kind of blood-crazed mob through the rainforest, you know, and he looks absolutely terrified, and you feel that kind of primordial terror,
yeah,
that you know you've been targeted by a mob and they want to rip you limb from limb, and you know, 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, that's what would have happened,
yeah,
and you kind of hope that the kind of barriers of civilization, the kind of protective barrier around you, which stops mobs tearing you apart. William Golding wrote interestingly about this in Lord of the Flies, and it's about the kind of gradual shrinking of that boundary that civilization protects you with to nothing.
Yeah.
You have this kind of terror that it is going to spill over. At the moment, it hasn't. And often people think, you know, you snowflake, all this kind of whiny, self-pitying crap about the penalties you've paid for being mobbed. You know, what about people who really suffer? And, you know, there's an element of truth in that. It's unpleasant and it can be extremely traumatic. And, you know, in some cases, people who've been mobbed have ended up committing suicide. Mm. So a woman called Jill Messick, who I knew very slightly, one of the producers of Mean Girls, she was named by Rose McGowan as someone who'd been complicit in Harvey Weinstein's crimes. She had worked at the agency that represented Rose McGowan, and Rose McGowan claimed she was first sexually assaulted by Harvey Weinstein. She had confided in Jill, and nothing happened as far as Rose McGowan was concerned. There were no repercussions for Harvey. And then sometime later, Jill got a job at Miramax. So Rose McGowan put two and two together and made five and thought there must have been some kind of behind the scenes hush up for which she was being rewarded, which actually turned out to be complete nonsense. And so she was mobbed, not just on social media, but in the mainstream media too, when Rose McGowan named her in this way. You know, what could be worse than a man who enables a sexual predator? A woman, you know, she was a quisling, worst kind of moral cowardice. She decided that she wasn't going to publicly defend herself because she didn't want to cast doubt on the veracity of other aspects of Rose McGowan's story and make it harder for other victims of Harvey and others to come forward. So she kept shtum. But she, in the end, found the distance between the person she was portrayed as being by these people piling on and the person she really is so great that in the end she took her own life.
By my calculation, I think there have been 4 Me Too-related suicides. Another one is Carl Sargent, and the Labour MP in Wales. And I think people sometimes underestimate the impact, not simply the accusations can have, which is the case of Carl Sargent, but also simply finding yourself dragged into the eye of a storm, being named, being shamed in the way that she was. The other example, this is a very different woman called Brenda Leyland, who in 2015 was exposed as one of the people who goes on Twitter and says that the McCanns murdered Madeleine, which is a conspiracy area I find pretty repulsive. Mm-hmm. She was part of that, and she used to often express her conspiracy theories. She was named and shamed in the media, and within 24 hours she had killed herself. People underestimate just how destructive the culture of public shaming can be, particularly when it's aimed at people who wouldn't normally be in the spotlight and don't have that kind of the skills or the raw materials to deal with that kind of attention. But I think one thing I was going to ask you about was the follow-up piece that you wrote just before Christmas about the impact that it had on your life. And it was a fairly short column, right? And it was about how your number of Christmas cards. Yeah. That was the thing everyone really picked up on. I don't mean to laugh. I know it's, it's not very nice. But that's the thing people picked up on, and people...
Well, no, you're perfectly right to laugh. It was supposed to be a self-deprecating you know, paragraph in the column. It wasn't supposed to be, oh, woe is me. Yeah. Take pity, please, and don't
dare laugh. The tone of the column is actually a fairly self-deprecating one. It's not woe is me in substance. But I was surprised, maybe I'm naive, but I was surprised that even the response to that piece was another outburst of, you know, screw this guy who gives a crap. He's awful, he's terrible, we hate him and we should hate him. So I just thought that I think was even in some ways a better example of the kind of culture we're talking about, which is this primitive, censorious, shrill, morally distinguishing culture of where you have to destroy someone and you have to keep on destroying them in kind of slow motion, repeat motion again and again and again in order to make yourself feel good and important. I thought the attacks on you for that piece were in some ways an even better illustration of that than what happened to you in January last year, because it just made me think, okay, so forgiveness is not an option. Is that what they're saying?
Well, I was quite surprised that people reacted on Twitter so negatively to that piece, and it immediately kind of got trending. I think one of the reasons I started that piece by talking about how different Christmas was last December to the previous December was partly because I wanted to set up the remainder of the piece, which was actually counterintuitively about the benefits of being defenestrated from public life. And so, of course, I wanted to slightly exaggerate in a self-deprecating way the penalties of being publicly shamed. But and actually, you know, there are some benefits, believe it or not. One of the things I always ask people who've also been publicly shamed, and, you know, I now, when we see each other at social gatherings, we gravitate naturally towards one another. It's like a kind of secret club of the deplorables. But one of the first questions I always ask is, you know, did you lose any weight? And the answer is always yes, about 2 stone. And when you are at the center of one
of the storm diet,
it must be some kind of primitive survival instinct kicking in. You know you're going to have to run away from this mob through the primeval forest, so you naturally start shedding pounds so you can run faster. But so that's one of the benefits. You lose weight. You suddenly find yourself with a lot more time on your hands. I found actually that since it all happened to me, my ability to appreciate music has become much, much better. So now when I listen to a piece of music, like, you know, one of Mozart's violin concertos or Beethoven's symphonies, it moves me. I feel like kind of, it makes me feel kind of ecstatic and moved in a way that it didn't before, hadn't for a very long time. And I think partly that must be to do with the impact of the trauma. Maybe it's a symptom, I don't know, of post-traumatic stress disorder. But it actually also feels as though, you know, when you're busy, when you have a really involving, time-consuming career, you don't have much time to focus on the kind of small quotidian things in your life. I mean, I was the chairman of this, the CEO of that for 10, 15 years, always spinning plates in my head, thinking about the next meeting, how to put out this particular fire, how to reconcile a, you know, a burgeoning dispute between two board members or whatever it might be. Always, you know, living in my head and never in the present. And so the opportunity to kind of live in the present again has actually been a benefit.
Well, that's a really interesting point. The other thing I was going to ask you about just on this issue before we move on to the other issues, this might help to connect them, is I think a lot of this hounding these attacks, these online attacks on people who have transgressed in some way, whether it's a minor transgression or a major transgression, really speaks to a broader, or speaks to and fuels a broader debasement of public life and public debate and political debate in particular. As we are recording this, there is this huge fury about the rather stupid self-styled yellow vest protesters outside Parliament who are continually trying to drown people out and branding them Nazis, like Anna Soubry, even though she is very clearly not a Nazi. And everyone seems quite shocked by this, but to me it makes perfect sense as an extension of the kind of culture that has been building over the past few years, where if you are a feminist who criticizes aspects of transgenderism, you are denounced as a TERF and cast out. If you are uncomfortable with same-sex marriage for religious reasons, you're a homophobe and you shouldn't speak on campuses. If you are worried about mass immigration, you're a xenophobe instantly, and that's it. Your career, your reputation is going to be called into question all the time. So there's this continual instinct to brand everyone a fascist, even though they clearly aren't, to write them off as phobic or deranged or problematic in some way. So it makes perfect sense to me that we're now reaching a point, it seems, where that's the hard right is embracing some of those tactics that were developed largely by the left and largely by SJWs. Yeah. And it's becoming this kind of very key part of public life. But what it means is that public life just becomes increasingly ugly and public debate becomes increasingly impossible. You're listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. It would be great if you could give us a rating and maybe even a review. That is a really good way to help new listeners discover the show. Let's talk about the intellectual dark web. That's where I want to take the question. So I think the intellectual dark web is very interesting. I think it has a lot of good qualities. A lot of my friends are in the intellectual dark web. But one problem I have with it is what I see as its increasing, not necessarily reliance upon, but its increasing movement towards a kind of explanation of human behavior that is a bit naturalistic or evolutionary or genetic. And I wanted to put that to you because one of the things that has been said about you, which is incorrect, is that you're a eugenicist. So you can explain to us why that's not true. But I think one of the things that's said about you, which is correct, is that you are interested in the role played by genes and DNA on things like intelligence. So if you could just explain why you aren't a eugenicist in the way that people have branded you, but why you are interested in those areas of work.
Okay. I wrote a piece for an Australian periodical called Quadrant in 2015. And it was about meritocracy and what I think of as one of the problems. Meritocracy has many problems, but one of the problems is or one of the risks anyway in a meritocratic society is that it descends into a biological caste system. That's quite a complicated argument to make. It's an argument that my father made in The Rise of the Meritocracy. It's an argument that Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray made in The Bell Curve. And it's been made by other critics of meritocracy. And the idea is that in a society in which merit, which my father defined as IQ plus effort, is the sole determinant of status. Given that IQ is in part inherited, we can argue about how heritable it is, and reversion to the mean, to a certain extent, undercuts this tendency. But nonetheless, what you see happening in advanced meritocratic societies, or what my father feared would happen and what Herrnstein and Murray claimed was happening in America, is that as the meritocracy matures, people who are of above average intelligence are more likely to couple up and have children. And whilst those children, on average, aren't going to be as intelligent as them, they're going to be nonetheless also on average above average. And what that means is you get this kind of sorting mechanism which gradually imposes on what appears initially to be a very open and fair and fluid society this kind of biological caste system. And it's certainly true in America. If you look at, there's plenty of evidence that it's begun to happen. Though, interestingly, there's a recent book by a couple of sociologists claiming it isn't happening. I said, okay, whether it's happening or not, and I think it is happening, sooner than we think, it's going to become possible for couples who want to have particularly intelligent children to fertilize a range of embryos in a genetics lab or a fertility clinic. And once we know more about the various genes linked to IQ and other qualities. And we are beginning to know more and more every day. You know, huge data sets are telling us more and more about which genes are linked with different behavioral traits. Once we know enough, it'll be possible for couples who want to take advantage of this new knowledge to have these various embryos tested and to implant and bring to term that one which is likeliest to have the highest intelligence. Now, you know, we saw in China last year with the first gene-edited baby born. That this kind of technology is not very far ahead of us in the future. My argument was, when this technology comes on stream, which I think it inevitably will, it's going to be used by the already very rich and very successful to give their children an even bigger head start than they currently enjoy, simply in virtue of coming from these extraordinarily privileged backgrounds. And that's going to exacerbate inequality. Inequality is going to get worse by an order of magnitude once this technology comes on stream. It's going to be difficult to regulate, because even if you ban its use in, say, the United Kingdom, it'd be hard to ban its use in China or Hong Kong or Singapore or Taiwan. You know, it's going to be hard to do it on a global scale. So what can we do about this likely exacerbation of inequality? And I suggested that one thing you might be able to do once this technology comes on stream would be to make it available to the least well-off on the NHS and in other, you know, socialized health services elsewhere for free. I wasn't suggesting it should be mandatory. And I wasn't suggesting, I was suggesting the opposite of sterilizing, you know, the least well-off. I was saying, give them fertility treatment for free, which they can take advantage of to give their own children a leg up, in the same way that rich people are going to be using that technology to give their children a leg up. And in that way, you can reduce, you can mitigate to a certain extent, and you can try and ban its use for everyone other than, you know, the least well off, and try and in that way try and mitigate the impact of this. And you know, it was a million miles away from what people commonly think of as eugenics. I wasn't proposing, you know, the sterilization of the poor or the mentally handicapped or homosexuals or anything like that. It was actually what I thought of as a progressive measure to try and mitigate what was likely to be worsening inequality as a result of this new tech coming on stream, which it undoubtedly will. But, you know, no one bothered to kind of think about, I don't think anyone read the piece. The nuance of the argument, you know, was completely ignored. People like Caroline Lucas put forward early day motions in the House of Commons saying, you know, with his horrific views on eugenics, why is Toby serving on the Office for Students? Polly Toynbee, you know, with his appalling eugenic views, why is Toby Young involved in education? It was just total nonsense, but really hard to kind of make people listen. I wasn't actually, you know, Dr. Mengele.
Yes, I thought it was a very good example. I mean, it was similar to when people say Nazi, fascist, alt-right. It's the word eugenicist was used to try and shut down that discussion. And there is a very kind of anti-intellectual, censorious climate around the whole question of genes and what role they might play. And I think that is a problem. I think academics, writers, thinkers, everybody should be completely at liberty to discuss the possibility of genetic influence on behavior and opportunity and intelligence and so on. But I still have a problem, which is, I have a number of problems, but one of them is that one of the points that critics in the US make off the idea of a kind of biological hierarchy is that they will argue that, in fact, what happens is that biology, whatever we mean by biology often maps itself onto social experience. So, you know, if there's a difference between blacks and whites, it might be less to do with biology and biological inheritance, for example, than it is to do with social opportunity, social experience, social origins, and so on. So, and I'm sure you'll be aware of that. But one issue I have, and I really wanted to ask you about this, is that One issue I have with the current culture war, as it's currently constituted, is that on one side you have this kind of blank slate thesis, mm-hmm. which is a pretty crude description, but we all know what it means, which is this idea that everyone is born completely blank, completely equal, and then we are shaped and determined by social experiences, parenting, the media, the patriarchy, and all these other things, which then apparently mm-hmm. determine how women behave, how men behave, and yep. so on. I have a problem with that. But then I worry that the response to that from the kind of anti-PC evolutionary psychology, Toby Young school, yep. Quillette school, I guess,
yep.
Actually makes a similar argument from a different perspective. So the argument then becomes, in fact, we're not blank slates. We are born with certain genetic predispositions in terms of character and outlook and talent and intelligence and so on. And my concern, I guess, is that both of them, what they share in common is something very important, which is that we are not as much masters of our fate as we thought we were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the element of this that worries me, because if you think, you know, the great idea of the Renaissance, I guess, and then through to the Enlightenment, was precisely that mankind can master his fate. One of the Renaissance writers who said through the deployment of intelligence and will, mankind can defeat fate. Mm-hmm. That was the great breakthrough idea. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if if we're caught in this tussle between the idea that we are socially determined to a certain extent or genetically determined to a certain extent. And I know that neither side say that we are fully determined by those things, but we are partially. Are we losing sight of the old humanist argument that even the poorest, most downtrodden person in the most difficult origins imaginable has it within his or her capacity to reshape the way he thinks, the way he acts, and the way he lives?
So you've covered quite a lot of ground in that question. I would begin by saying, when members of the intellectual dark web, like Jordan Peterson, talk about the evolutionary origins of hierarchies in human societies and indeed in lobster societies, that's often heard by people on the social justice left as a social Darwinist justification for the status quo, with all the horror that implies. And a point that many members of the IDW have been at pains to make is that merely describing something and explaining how something came about by appealing to the human sciences like and the behavioral sciences like evolutionary psychology, behavioral genetics, sociobiology, Darwinian anthropology, and so forth, you are not actually defending what is. You're just describing it. And you're not saying that because this is the way it is, this is the way it ought to be.
Mm.
People in the IDW are not committing the naturalistic fallacy. It's people on the social justice left who are committing that fallacy. And one of the ways in which they commit the fallacy is to imagine that if you assert that there are some differences, some human differences that are hardwired, to do with our natures and to do with our different capacities at birth, and that we're not born as blank slates, they fear, because they commit the naturalistic fallacy, that that will invalidate the kind of equal rights, equal treatment, equal opportunities agenda. They think that if you can show, for instance, that there are some differences between men and women, if you defend, for instance, the greater human variability hypothesis, which posits that the cognitive distribution curve is flatter for women than it is for men, and you have more men at either tail, so more very stupid men and more very smart men
yeah.
than women. And there's, you know, there's a substantial weight of evidence to show that that is true. There is this fear by members of the social justice left that if you defend hypotheses like that, that you're actually saying women shouldn't have equal rights. And the point that
yeah.
Pinker and Peterson and countless others make endlessly, but it always seems to fall on deaf ears, is that no, you make the moral case for equal rights. And we all believe in equal rights, equal treatment, equal opportunity. We embrace the civil rights agenda. We embrace the feminist agenda. We are not trying to roll back the clock on any of those gains made by liberals in the 20th century. We embrace the whole of that, but you don't have to appeal to the idea, the blank slate hypothesis, in order to defend all those gains. But I think where it gets a bit murkier is that if you're not a blank slatist, and you think that some psychological differences are partly genetically based, and if you think that we are born with some, you know, default apps which predispose us to behave in particular ways, I think that does place important limits on what you can reasonably expect to achieve politically in a liberal society. I don't think it places anything like the limits that people on the social justice left imagine it does. I don't think it means that you have to therefore embrace a kind of Randian kind of fundamental free market. I think that social democracy, as practiced in Sweden, is completely compatible with a kind of mature and scientifically literate understanding of human nature. So it doesn't place limits on what's possible within liberal democratic societies. But it does mean that various projects, which I think of as having come out of the Enlightenment, like utopian socialism, may not be possible to achieve without substantially curtailing human freedom in a way which most people, if they understood that that was a cost, would reject. So I think that's one reason. It's partly because they think the whole liberal rights agenda is contingent on the blank slate hypothesis, that they're very unwilling to give it up. But partly because I think instinctively they recognize that if the blank slate isn't true, then we have to, as Kant said, devise political institutions which allow for the fact that we are a nation of devils, not a nation of angels. And if you create these institutions and you embark on these projects, which are contingent upon human beings behaving well and always listening to their better angels, or on the belief that they can be completely molded into kind of these new citizens who aren't going to be in any way affected by the desire for competition or dominance, and are not going to be aggressive in the way that they have been dating back to, you know, the dawn of time. If you imagine that mankind can be completely remolded by institutions, then, you know, you're on a hiding to nothing, and you're going to end up with Cambodia or China under Mao's Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, I see all that. And I don't doubt for a minute that most of the kind of good, decent, thoughtful members of the intellectual dark web do very strongly believe in equality and many of the gains of the 1960s. In fact, they believe in those things often more than the SJWs who see themselves as the heirs to that.
If you just take Martin Luther King's principle that people should be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin, that is, you know, a nostrum of the intellectual dark web. It is not a nostrum of the social justice left, as you pointed out earlier.
You're listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. If you liked this podcast and Spike's other podcasts, and also the articles and essays that Spiked publishes every day, please think about giving us a donation. Spike's content is free, and we want to keep it free, and donations really help us to do that. Head over to Spike's donation page now at www.spiked-online.com. The thing that still concerns me, I guess, is that I think both sides emphasize the need for a kind of remolding. So the SJW side, which we can all agree is not a particularly useful, all-encompassing term for the kind of people we're talking about, but that kind of left-leaning side, as they see themselves, sees the remolding as having to come through challenging masculinity in young boys, for example, or banning certain adverts so that people don't become rapacious and crazy, or going into the universities and changing the way in which you educate people and what you encourage them to read. And it's all driven by this sense that by the blank slate thesis, which means not only that do they have this kind of slightly utopian view that everyone is born the exact same, but also it means that they believe we're very moldable and that we can just be treated like putty. So they have this very authoritarian view of the human capacity. But I sometimes fear that I see, or hear rather, echoes of that in the pushback against that culture, which then suggests, well, probably a better way to mold people is to investigate the possibility of genetic editing, or to think about creating institutions which will hold at bay inevitable evolutionary and tribal traits. Mm-hmm. So I'm worried about the way in which both sides emphasize an element of either molding or control or institutionalization over what I would consider to have been, you know, the kind of small p progressive view of the past, which is that people have it within their capacity to govern their life regardless of what their ancestors did hundreds of thousands of years ago, or regardless of whether their parents beat them every day until they were 7 years old. So both of those positive views that you can overcome nature and nurture seems to have disappeared. And one issue I have, because when the genetic determinism is unfair, I appreciate that, because I know people will always say it's not genes alone. There are other contributory factors to what makes a human being. But when that idea really started to become fashionable again in the 1970s, I guess, and then through to today, one of the critiques that was made of it was that it appeared as a kind of almost religious style, all-encompassing explanation for something which is incredibly difficult to understand, which is why human beings are what they are and why they behave the way they behave. That's something we all struggle to explain. Do you think there's a possibility that both sides in the current culture wars are looking for a convenient, all-encompassing explanation for something which just might be rather too mysterious for us to be able to understand?
Robert Plomin, the doyen of behavioural geneticists, a professor at King's College London, wrote a book called Blueprint, which was published last year, summarising the kind of state of knowledge in behavioural genetics. And partly because he chose the title Blueprint, he had the mantle of genetic determinist foisted upon him. But he is actually at pains throughout the book to make the point that the fact that our behavior is influenced by our genes, and that many important life-changing traits like conscientiousness, agreeableness, intelligence, and so forth are at least 50% heritable, has a probabilistic effect on how we behave, but not a deterministic effect. And the example he gives is that he has what's called a high polygenic risk score for obesity. So he has the various genes and subsets of genes associated with obese people. But that doesn't mean he has no choice but to be obese. And it doesn't mean that on learning this, he should just surrender himself to his genetic fate. He's not obese. And even though his polygenic risk score for obesity is, you know, up there in the 70th plus percentile, that doesn't mean that, you know, his destiny is written in stone. I mean, I think of it more not as encouraging a kind of fatalism which is comparable to the fatalism of the social justice left on the right. I just think of it as giving us a framework which enables us to better understand not only what's politically, realistically possible, but what the likely costs are of trying to pursue various utopian projects, whether of the right or the left.
I think what's interesting to me in relation to what you've just said about Plomin, whose work is incredibly interesting, I guess the question of emphasis, because you could easily argue that there is genetic influence on how people turn out and how they behave and what they believe and what they become. But then you could respond to that by emphasizing the role of free will in doing exactly what Plomin seems to have done with the potential tendency to obesity, which is to defeat that and to overcome it and to refuse to surrender to it. So I do worry about the downplaying of free will, whether it's in relation to supposedly patriarchal structures or white philosophy or anything else that apparently controls us, and or in relation to the genetic stuff. Now, I know it is more nuanced than that in certain things.
But you're sort of saying it's bad because if people say we don't have any free will, then we're less likely to exercise our free will. But it might be that actually those two things aren't connected, and how much free will we can exercise is something that's beyond our control and isn't, like, you're almost kind of accepting the premise of the kind of socialist left that these currents and discourses fundamentally dictate our self-understanding and our behavior, when actually the kind of lesson of the behavioral sciences is that their influence is much smaller than you think. Just on the conviction by the social justice left that these various malign forces are shaping human behavior, I don't think that's just something they have taken from, you know, the tradition of progressive left-wing thought dating back to the Enlightenment. I also think there's a kind of element of magical thinking in there, and it's a manifestation of the primitive religious aspects of the social justice left. So, for instance, the idea of stereotype threat. Stereotype threat maintains that the reason, say, a teenage girl underperforms in a maths test is because her male maths teacher has a stereotype in his head whereby boys are better than girls at maths. And this explains why there are fewer women in leadership positions in tech companies like Google, and fewer women doing STEM subjects, fewer tenured professors, female tenured professors, and so forth. But actually, stereotype threat is one of those psychological nostrums that has failed the replication crisis. And it looks like it's just not real. It's just a figment, literally a figment of people's imagination. But the idea of unconscious bias is another good example. Again, hasn't fared well in the current kind of more scientifically rigorous environment in psychology. Quite hard to stand up. The implicit association test is notoriously unreliable. The evidence that unconscious bias is having this kind of terribly negative impact on outcomes for women and minorities and so forth is threadbare. And again, it's this belief that there is this kind of malignant force which is controlling people. One of the awful things about this magical thinking on the left is that there are these outcome disparities which we should be concerned about. You know, in some cases, women aren't as well represented as they should be. Some ethnic minorities aren't performing as well as they might be. And, you know, the reasons for that are multifactorial. And, you know, unless we abandon this magical thinking that it's all to do with stereotype threat, unconscious bias, systematic racism and sexism, the patriarchy, and so forth, unless we, you know, those things clearly aren't the sole determinants of these outcome discrepancies. And if you continue to obsess about them and just focus all your energy on trying to get rid of those things, you're not going to solve the problem. If you really care about outcome disparities and minorities and women not doing as well as they should be and not being as well represented as they might be, then let's find out the real reasons and actually do something about it and not come up with these invented magical reasons which somehow involve blaming demons inside white people.
Yes, I agree with all of that. My concern, I guess, is the possibility that some of those ridiculous claims about demons, psychological demons or patriarchal demons or social demons, find replication in the pushback, but it becomes more, not necessarily genetic demons, but genetic influences. So that's my concern, which I will no doubt be concerned about for much more time to come. But in relation to the free will issue, where you say, you know, maybe I'm suggesting that the kind of diminution of free will has this kind of controlling impact on how then people conceive of themselves. I think that it's possible that the downplaying of free will in contemporary society, I don't think it determines how people see themselves, but I think it acts as an invitation to irresponsibility. So Plomin, for example, doesn't excuse his lifestyle by saying, I have a tendency to obesity, but we know that many other people do. And I think one of the worrying trends about today is that people will often say, well, I can't help being fat, it's in my genes, or I can't help failing to get a job, I just don't have the right aptitude aptitude, or they will say, on the flip side, I can't help being a woman who's not in science because it freezes me out with its implicit bias. So there is this tendency to excuse making, which I think does spring from the devaluing of the idea of free will, which is the idea that even in the most difficult circumstances, you can master your fate if you genuinely choose to.
What you're claiming, which is that the downgrading of free will has a negative impact on people's performance, because if they think of themselves as lacking agency, they're likely to make less effort and not do anything to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. That's a testable empirical hypothesis. And insofar as it has been tested, it's been found to be false. So a good example is growth mindset. So there is this kind of fad, this all-conquering current fad in education, which stretches across the Western world and into the developing world, this belief people, children who believe that their ability is fluid and that how they do is intimately bound up with how much effort they make and whether they think of themselves as the agents of their own life story, the authors of their own life story, that those children are going to do better than the children who take a more fatalistic attitude and who think of mental cognitive ability as fixed. There's the fixed mindset and the growth mindset. Some initial experiments were done 20 more years ago, seeming to show, but with tiny sample sizes and under dubious circumstances, seeming to show that people with a growth mindset outperform those with a fixed mindset. Actually, it's been incredibly hard to replicate those experiments. And if you see the meta-analyses of all the research in the mindset field, the effect of growth mindset is tiny. I mean, it's not statistically insignificant, but it's negligible.
Well, that's interesting, because I guess one of the responses people might have to being told that that's who you are, stay there, it's all fixed, you can't do much about it, might actually be to grate against that and say, well, screw you, I'm going to show you different, which I guess speaks to precisely the unpredictability of human behavior. But
so just one final point on the your seeming attachment to mindset theory is that it does lead people, it can lead to very harsh judgments being made of people who are not performing well. You think, well, you know, if ability isn't fixed and if it is intimately bound up with effort, then you're just not trying hard enough. And that's a kind of denial of other factors which may be at work. And if you overestimate people's ability to make their own luck and control their own destinies, then if they're not doing well, there is this tendency to unjustly blame them for that rather than other factors over which they might not have much control.
Although I still do think it's worth saying to people, you should try bloody hard. Toby Young, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back next month with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. See you next month. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.